This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. The present-day fight for voting rights starts and ends with the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It was a landmark piece of legislation designed to give free and full voting access to previously disenfranchised African Americans in the South, and it helped register black voters by the millions. But 2 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a key provision of law, the one that required some southern counties to submit any changes in their voting laws to the federal government for review. Several states, including North Carolina, have passed new elections laws since then, requiring a photo ID, reducing the early voting period, and eliminating same-day registration. So are voting rights under assault again? Political reporter Ari Berman tells the modern story of voting in a new book called Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari Berman's a political correspondent for The Nation and joins me now on The State of Things. Welcome, Ari.
Thank you, Frank.
I guess we can say the struggle really begins after the Civil War. African Americans win emancipation and full citizenship rights, including voting and voting rights. And soon after Reconstruction, Southern whites are stripping those through a variety of practices, poll taxes, literacy tests, and outright violence. That's the first effort to strip things away. You pick it up with the Voting Rights Act. Tell us about what happened in the immediate aftermath of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. In terms of African-American access to the polls.
Well, you're absolutely right, Frank, that there's an odd situation, which is we pass the 15th Amendment to try to end the problem of voting discrimination. We say the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged on the basis of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And then for a brief 10-year period of Reconstruction, we enforce the 15th Amendment. Then we essentially ignore it for 95 years. And so the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is essentially passed just to enforce the 15th Amendment, something that was passed 95 years earlier. And what the VRA does is a few transformative immediate things. It knocks out literacy tests and poll taxes that had prevented African Americans from voting for decades. It sends federal examiners to the South to begin to register black voters, which is revolutionary in a place like Selma, Alabama, where no African Americans have been registered for decades. And black voter registration increases immediately by the hundreds and then by the thousands and eventually by the millions. Then it keeps federal officials in the South to monitor elections to make sure they're not stolen in places like Selma, Alabama, when these Southern segregationists are up for re-election. And then over a longer period of time, a period of decades, the Voting Rights Act forces those states with the worst histories of voting discrimination, which included 40 counties in North Carolina, to have to approve their voting changes with the federal government to prevent discrimination from happening in the future. So it both had an immediate impact and then also a very long-term impact as well.
And something you said in there is very important. It puts the federal government on the side of voting rights for African Americans and says there are two sides in this, because we've seen the systematic disenfranchisement of African Americans in the South. We as the federal government are going to resist that. We're going to end that and systematically be in favor of voting rights. So it puts the federal government on the side of voting rights for African Americans.
It gave the federal government an incredible power that it had not had before. And what the federal government said is that the 15th Amendment had been ignored for 95 years and it was time to enforce it. And the Civil Rights Act of 1957, 1960, and 1964 also didn't solve the problem. So we passed three Civil Rights Acts before the Voting Rights Act, which didn't end the disenfranchisement of black voters in places like Selma. So the federal government, the LBJ, the Congress, the Justice Department, they said, we're going to do everything we can to solve this problem once and for all so we don't have to pass a Voting Rights Act of 1966, 67, and 68 to try to solve this problem going forward.
And as we saw in the aftermath of the Reconstruction, there was in the 1960s, once again, a counter-revolution. Tell us what happened.
There was. The Southern states really never learned to live with this thing. First, they challenged the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act immediately. They lost in court in an 8-1 decision where the Supreme Court, on actually the first anniversary of Bloody Sunday, so March 7th, 1966, upheld the constitutionality of the VRA. Then what you started to see is states like Mississippi began to change their election laws to prevent newly registered African-American voters from being able to run for office and to be elected. And this was the next wave of the fight over voting rights. It was a fight not just about registration, but about representation. Would these newly emancipated voters actually have real power, real say in terms of who they elected? So Mississippi did things like they would switch from district to countywide election, so the white majority would remain in control, or they would gerrymander lines to prevent a black candidate from being elected, or they would have someone be elected from multiple districts where the white majority could elect everyone from those multiple districts, a situation that you had in North Carolina as well. And so it took decades to knock down these new discriminatory election schemes. And that became the next battle when it came to voting rights.
And I think probably one of the most exquisite symbols of this it was the re-election campaign of Jim Clark in Selma, the sheriff in Selma, Alabama. Tell us that story.
Well, Jim Clark is the tyrannical sheriff of Selma who enforced segregation by any means necessary and really was responsible for the atrocities on Bloody Sunday in Selma when people like John Lewis nearly died marching for voting rights. And Clark was up for re-election in 1966 against a more moderate white candidate. And Clark basically tried to steal the election. He wanted to prevent all these ballots from predominantly black wards of Selma from being counted. He said that the ballots were infected with voter fraud, and the Justice Department challenged him. They appealed under the Voting Rights Act. The ballots were counted, and Clark was defeated. So that was a real sign of the power of the Voting Rights Act. The most prominent symbol of opposition to voting rights was defeated, and that he tried to steal the election. He was prevented from doing so under the VRA. That showed the VRA was going to have real power. And it's interesting because the same arguments about voter fraud that Clark was making in 1966, of course, have been resurrected by many in the Republican Party today.
Tell us about North Carolina's place in all of this in the Voting Rights Act.
Well, it was an important state. It wasn't as important initially as a place like Alabama or Mississippi because you had a higher percentage of black voters registered in North Carolina. But the fact that you had 40 counties in North Carolina that had to approve their voting changes with the federal government meant that any statewide voting change in North Carolina had to be approved by the federal government. What also happened over a larger period of time in North Carolina is that a bunch of cases from North Carolina reached the Supreme Court. And in the 1986 case Thornburg versus Jingle, the Supreme Court laid out a test for how to strike down districts or election system that prevented African Americans from being represented. And that was really important because after the Supreme Court laid out this new test for striking down these election systems, you started to see a dramatic rise in minority representation in places like North Carolina in the 80s and the 90s. And so I think the Voting Rights Act was important in the 1960s in North Carolina, but it was even more important in the decades after in ensuring fair representation.
Well, and as you point out in your book, what's important about these tests is that they start answering the question, how will you prove it? How are you going to prove that our rights have been taken away? And that question, the balance, the who has the burden of proof, becomes critical in enforcing the Voting Rights Act, right?
Well, it does. There's a brief period where the Supreme Court says in 1980 that you have to prove intentional discrimination to block down, to strike down a discriminatory election system. And that's the first time the Supreme Court has ever held that. And it's the first time the court has really weakened the Voting Rights Act. And there's a big effort to try to overrule this decision. It becomes a major fight between the Reagan administration and the Congress. And the Reagan administration is trying to keep the test for intentional discrimination. The Congress is trying to overrule it. Very influential young lawyers in the Reagan Justice Department, including John Roberts, who later becomes Chief Justice, of course, of the Supreme Court, are doing everything they can to try to limit discrimination to intentional discrimination because that's so much more difficult to prove. The Congress ultimately wins that fight. The Voting Rights Act is not only reauthorized, but you just have to show the effect of discrimination, not the intent. The fact that you only have to show the effect of discrimination allows so many of these discriminatory election schemes to be struck down in the decades after that. It allows real representation in places like North Carolina, and it allows for challenges under the Voting Rights Act today.
There really was a sea change in the Reagan administration about the federal government's position with regard to voting rights through the Reagan administration. Tell us about that change, because Reagan at one point, you point out in the book, would have supported reauthorization of the bill, but was told by the people who were, had some authority within his White House that he shouldn't do that.
Well, the first thing you have to remember was Reagan opposed the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and the 1968 Fair Housing Act. So he was the first legitimate Republican nominee and the first Republican president to oppose all of these things. Nixon had gone back and forth with his Southern strategy, but he was never a full-out opponent of the civil rights laws of the 1960s in a way that Ronald Reagan was. Reagan was much more of a Goldwater conservative on civil rights issues. And then he comes in, and a whole flock of people, a whole new generation of conservative legal figures follow Reagan into the White House. And really, the Justice Department becomes the center of resistance to the civil rights laws of the 1960s. You have the Attorney General William French Smith. You have the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, William Bradford Reynolds, who's very influential. Then under him, you have these young lawyers like John Roberts. And they're cutting their teeth by opposing the VRA, by making the argument that the Voting Rights Act will lead to things like quotas in the electoral sphere, like affirmative action for elections. And they're making this critique across the board about all civil rights efforts, but they're making it specifically about the Voting Rights Act. And what you see going forward is that that movement is very influential in conservative legal circles, that counter-revolution against civil rights. And if you look at the current Supreme Court that gutted the Voting Rights Act, all five justices in the majority in that 2013 case were either appointed by Reagan or served in his administration. So definitely the Reagan era is still with us today.
It's interesting to focus a light, shine a light on that moment in American history and that particular administration and the way things changed, because it gets to this question of intent, the question about any of the new restrictions in North Carolina, for instance. Well, what's the real intent here? Was it fraud, or is this a deliberate effort to disenfranchise blacks at the expense or the Democratic Party to chip off black voters? And you can't really get at that until you look at this, because there's a question about why not co-opt the black vote, let them vote and do what Nixon did in the Southern strategy, take previously Democratic voters and make them Republican, or do what Reagan did in the industrial Midwest by telling Democratic voters that, in fact, their fortunes lie with the Republicans. Why not do that with African-American voters?
Well, that's the problem. There's a contradiction. You can't court the white backlash vote that's opposed to civil rights and then also court African-American voters at the same time. And this is the same conundrum that Republicans are facing nowadays, which is there was this dramatic turnout of African-American voters, of younger voters, of Latino voters for Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012. And I believe that's what's motivating these new restrictions in places like North Carolina, that Republicans in the legislature are trying to make the electorate older, whiter, and more conservative, as opposed to younger, more diverse, more progressive. Because if you look at the voting methods that they're cutting back on, same-day registration, early voting, these were things that were overwhelmingly used by minority voters and by younger voters. And so to take them away hurts that segment of the electorate in particular.
Tell us about the presidential election in 2000 and why that was another important turning point in this story.
Well, it was such an important turning point because there was a massive voter purge in the run-up to the Florida election, and thousands of people were wrongly labeled as felons. You couldn't vote if you were an ex-felon in Florida. So thousands of people were wrongly labeled as felons and prevented from voting, and they were disproportionately African-American because African-Americans were 11% of that voter purge list, but 44% – 11% of Florida's electorate, but 44% of the voter purge list. And so what happened when thousands of people were wrongly turned away from the polls in the Florida 2000 election was they were disproportionately African-American. The Civil Rights Commission found that it violated the Voting Rights Act, and it set two really negative precedents. One precedent was that I think elements of the Republican Party realized that small manipulations in the electoral process, like Florida's voter purge, could make a real difference. The second thing is that it emboldened a new Bush administration, which focused on voter fraud and appointed two justices to the Supreme Court, John Roberts and Sam Alito, who gutted the Voting Rights Act. And so without Florida 2000, I don't think you would see the widespread effort to restrict voting rights that we're seeing today.
You cover the federal trial that challenges North Carolina's election law. Tell us why that might be a new precedent and why that case is so important.
Well, it's so important because a month after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, North Carolina passed all these voting changes. So cutting early voting, requiring strict voter ID, eliminating same-day voter registration, ending pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds. Other states have done some form of this, but no state had done it all at the same time in one bill. And that was really shocking to people. And so the trial is going to have a major precedent, I think, because the courts have to think about what do you do when you take away reforms that have made it easier for people to vote. So it's not just the voter ID law, which gets all the attention. It's the fact that same-day registration, early voting, pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds, are these things that voters fundamentally should have, or are they just conveniences that can be taken away? And if the courts find that these are things that helped voters and they shouldn't be removed without a very good reason, then it'll set a precedent for protecting voting rights in the future. If the court finds, however, that basically these are just conveniences that a state can take away essentially on a whim, then that will lead to more states passing new restrictions and make it much harder to challenge these kind of laws.
What about that second argument, though? The fact is there are states that don't have any early voting, that don't have any of these conveniences, and no one challenges the constitutionality of their voting process. Aren't these just conveniences? And if you'll just have to do without them, other states do.
Well, I think it's unfortunate that states like New York, where I am now, don't have early voting and same-day registration. But the fact is, voters are used to what happens in their states. They don't know the election laws of New York, for example. So if you have early voting and same-day registration, then you cut back on it, voters are going to be impacted in that state. And what we saw in the 2014 election in North Carolina is that thousands of voters were turned away from the polls because of these new restrictions. The second thing I'll say about this is that voter turnout increased dramatically in North Carolina for everybody as a result of these changes. North Carolina went from 37th in voter turnout in 2000 to 11th in 2012. And that, of course, was also because North Carolina became a swing state. But what you saw is that previously disenfranchised groups like African Americans, their turnout increased dramatically after North Carolina adopted these new reforms. So they may be conveniences, but they helped a large segment of society. And if we're going to take them away, I think we should have a good reason to do so. And I didn't hear the state of North Carolina present a very good case for getting rid of all these things.
Ari Berman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Frank.
Ari Berman, a political correspondent for The Nation. His new book is called Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. You can find out more about it at our website, stateofthings.org. Tomorrow's program, Duke University's Dan Ariely is going to be here, and he will answer your question. He is the guy who tells us how irrational we are and how predictable that is. His research into human behavior is always paradoxical and upending, and you can give him a call tomorrow on our show when we talk with Dan Ariely for the whole hour, 877-962-9862. Get that number down, or you can send us an email, sot@wnc.org, when we talk with Dan Ariely tomorrow on The State of Things, a program that is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Widarski's sitting in today. Andrew Tye's our intern. Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.